This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Place on the planet. The battle over coal trains carrying Powder River coal across the Pacific Northwest has been heating up in recent months. Originally, six terminals were proposed in Washington and Oregon, where the coal would be transferred from trains to ships bound for Asia. The plug has been pulled on three of these terminals, but the struggle to stop the coal trains is far from over. This morning, we'll talk about the cumulative effects of shipping millions of tons of coal via train from Montana and Wyoming to ports on the West Coast, just to feed Asia's insatiable appetite for burning coal. My guest is Ryan Alexander with Taxpayers for Common Sense. Ryan, welcome to Wilkes Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wonder if we could start by talking about why there's such a push to continue mining coal in the Powder River Valley and to ship it to Asia when there's a decreasing demand for coal here in the United States.
Well, I think at the end of the day, coal companies are in the business to mine and sell coal, and they want to make some money. So there's an opportunity to do that the way in the current management system. And so they're thinking, hey, we can do it this way, and they'll make some money out of it. I think it's the responsibility of Congress and the federal government, and particularly the Department of Interior, to kind of be a good manager and steward of our public lands and make sure that we're not giving away the farm, so to speak. I think this is, you know, as we see this problem, it's really a problem of the United States government not doing its fiduciary duty on behalf of taxpayers. If we have an asset, you know, we should ask the question, what are the long-term liabilities? Why? What are we doing here before we develop it? But if we're going to develop it, we got to make sure we get fair market price for that. And the current coal leasing situation is really allowing coal companies to make big profits by exporting the resource.
Well, we'll get to the finances of this in a little bit, but I was just thinking about some remarks I heard by a representative from Peabody Coal about 3 years ago at a conference I went to, where he was arguing that on one hand, he was talking about how Peabody Coal was helping very remote areas of Siberia to develop their ability to burn coal. And I'm assuming they were going to be doing some mining of coal there, but also doing some shipping of U.S. coal. But he was saying basically that coal is being burnt all around the rest of the world, so the United States shouldn't give up on coal because everybody else is doing it. So what kinds of problems would you have with that mindset?
Well, I think, you know, Our organization, Taxpayers for Common Sense, we're a federal budget watchdog. So we want to make sure from our perspective that what's happening in the federal government is that, you know, that the agencies are looking out for our best interests. And it is certainly the case that you can sell coal overseas, but kind of what's the purpose of our federal lands? You know, it's hard to argue that anybody, you know, from Theodore Roosevelt on down thought what we should do with our collectively owned taxpayer assets is mine them and sell that coal overseas. There's kind of either for way below price. Either we should, you know, there are people who argue that any natural resources on public lands and taxpayer-owned lands should be managed and stewarded for domestic energy security, and others who you know, there are plenty of people who think we shouldn't have public lands, but we do have them, and we got to manage them for value. But there's kind of nobody who says what we should do. Let private companies make a lot of money off of our public assets by shipping it overseas. In terms of the reasoning of Peabody and thinking about this kind of, hey, everybody's mining coal, so we should not give up on it, you know, the demand for energy is not going to decrease. We got to be pursuing kind of every opportunity we have to figure out kind of what to do about that. So, you know, Peabody's a coal company. It's in the business of selling coal. But the Department of Interior is a federal agency that should be in the business of making sure that we're managing our natural resources for long-term taxpayer value, and that's not what's happening right now.
Well, there's been a lot of concern, I think, about the Mining Act. I can't remember what year, back in the 19th century, we have some very antiquated mining laws that we're still following.
We do have very antiquated mining laws. So, the 1872 General Mining Law is probably what you're thinking about.
So let's talk a little bit about sort of the history of, because this is not a new thing that the federal government is leasing land to private companies for way under cost. Isn't this actually built into the Mining Act of 1872?
Well, the interesting thing about the 1872 Mining Law, which is really one of my favorite things to talk about, so I won't go off on the longest tangent, but it doesn't actually cover coal. 1872 Mining Law covers hard rock minerals like gold and molybdenum, and they allow that law allows companies to go onto public lands and extract resources and pay the United States zero, no royalty at all. And it's totally crazy. It was kind of a law designed to help kind of manage and encourage development of the West. I think the West is developed. I think the West is populated. I think we've met that goal. So now we're left with this incredibly antiquated law that no one in the world, no landowner in the world would say, hey, I've got a gold deposit under my house. You want to come take the gold away from me? That would be great. And that's basically what we do under 1872. You know, the one good thing you can say about the way we manage other mineral extraction like coal is that we do charge something, but we're charging way below market value. And that's been the big problem with these exports, is that the coal companies see that they can make more money overseas, that the United States government hasn't pulled it together to kind of bring this leasing program in order so that they make sure we're getting fair market value. And so the coal companies are profiting at the taxpayers' expenses.
Well, actually, I have a flyer in front of me for an event that's happening here on the Columbia River, just north of Portland, this Sunday. It's a part of Summer Heat, and it's organized by the Portland Rising Tide and 350 Portland. And it's Pacific Northwest says no to fossil fuel exports, and it's a protest to stop the proposed coal terminals that are considering being built in Washington and Oregon. And part of the they have like the what, where, when, and why, and the why is if we can stop the export, then we'll leave it in the ground. So let's talk a little bit about that thinking. Is it, in your mind, I know you're more about looking at the fiduciary responsibilities of the U.S. government to the taxpayers, but how about besides financial concerns, are there other kinds of larger intrinsic reasons for leaving the rest of the coal deposits that we have in this country in the ground at this point?
You know, I think this is, I think the environmental community, as you can tell from that, I mean, their concerns are, as we see the increase of carbon in the atmosphere and the need to decrease carbon. And I think, you know, one of the things is, you know, we always like to say this here, it's like there's nobody who's saying what we need is more carbon in the atmosphere. Even people who don't feel like climate change is a top priority problem don't say, so what we should do is make sure we get more carbon in the atmosphere. That's just not a position anybody has. So I think that for the folks for whom climate change and reducing carbon in the atmosphere is a top priority, and that's a lot of people, keeping coal in the ground is going to further that goal. You know, for us, we look at extraction from public lands, again, both to make sure that taxpayers are being compensated if you take things out, but also to make sure that we're not creating long-term liabilities and creating harm that we can't undo. And coal mining is an extremely disruptive process to the natural landscape, and it can kind of hurt water tables. It can do a lot of other damage down the line. And, you know, our position is essentially we just don't see the rush to get this coal out of the ground so that the companies can make the most money. We want to make sure that we avoid long-term liabilities and that the taxpayers are compensated. But absolutely, and I'm sure you've had guests from groups that for whose their primary goal is climate change or carbon reduction. For them, it's just all about making sure that we reduce carbon emissions.
But actually, it seems like reducing carbon emissions is going to be an important issue for taxpayers down the line, too. I mean, I'm reading a book right now about the speeding up consequences of climate change, and a lot of the consequences are going to be either replacing very expensive infrastructure as well as all kinds of major public health issues. So do you see that?
Absolutely. We see there are fiscal consequences to pretending like there's nothing happening. You know, the GAO puts out a report every couple of years on high-risk programs, and one of the things they identified as a risk this year was the failure of agencies to plan for climate change, because we're seeing bigger storms, we're seeing bigger and more frequent storms, and if we're not prepared for that, if we're not prepared, well, they'll be even more costly, but we can expect more costs to begin with. So we definitely see that there are potentially significant federal costs by not planning for and doing mitigation and doing what we can to reduce carbon emissions. Our position has always been that that this is a good reason to have a carbon tax. It's a very reasonable way to say, okay, you tax what you don't want. You don't want more carbon. Let's figure out a way to do that.
Actually, let's talk a bit more about the carbon tax, because it's something that I've had some guests who are very nervous about carbon taxes, and and in fact, there's been a whole issue with Australia scrapping its carbon tax, I guess, last week. So let's talk a bit about why the carbon tax is such a controversial idea and what the ups and the downsides of it are.
I mean, I think the carbon tax is, you know, it's one of those things, like everything else, the devil are in the details. The basic idea of you should tax what you don't want, and everybody agrees, we don't want more carbon in the atmosphere, so that will change the market dynamics and force businesses to use less carbon is something that I think people think, oh, that's a great idea. But there's a lot of controversy because that presumes that then energy costs will go up and that'll hit consumers, particularly low-income consumers, in a difficult way. So I think there's a lot of people who feel like, well, you know, it's a good idea to tax what you don't want, but is this just going to shift costs to lower and middle-income consumers? Well, you know, the wealthiest businesses will just pay a little more and pass those costs down. I think that's one of those things that can be worked out in the details. There's lots of different ways to structure it by reducing other taxes that hit lower and middle income consumers. There's been cap and dividend proposals. We look at the range of proposals, but I think one of the key controversies is kind of how does this hit consumers? And I think the other controversy, particularly in the United States, is really what can we expect from Congress? Do people think, wow, the Congress, that has demonstrated itself to be a great policymaking body? No, that's not the public sense right now. People are worried that, you know, if the devil's in the details, what are we going to do with this Congress that has such a difficult time coming to real agreement on different issues?
Well, especially since John...
think that's, you know, a valid concern.
Actually, since John Boehner said the other day that the Congress should be remembered for how many laws it repeals, not how many laws it passes, I thought that...
You know,
he's just sort of summing up what I think a lot of people think about Congress right now.
Right, right.
Well,
right. This is a very, I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard to know what history will say about any particular era, but I think it's hard to imagine that that history will look back at Congress in this period of time and think, that's exactly what we want Congress to be. Whether you're coming from the right or the left, kind of this level of discord and this inability of Congress to move forward and actually make decisions is really a real problem.
Now, are you familiar at all with some of the reasons why the Australian carbon tax failed and why was it withdrawn for political reasons or was it actually failing?
I'm not as familiar with the Australian carbon tax case. It's something that I wish I could talk about. I'll go read more about it, but we really focus on developing U.S. policies.
Okay. Well, one of the things that in the information I got about your group and the issues that you're dealing with was talking about the cumulative effects of sending millions of tons of Powder River Basin coal across Montana to the ports in Washington and Oregon, and that the Army Corps of Engineers rejected studying the cumulative effects. So let's talk a little bit about what these cumulative effects are and why the Army Corps doesn't want to study them.
Well, as you may not know, but you know, we have long opposed the deepening of the ports in Portland itself, and I think we look at the infrastructure, both the Army Corps of Engineers kind of investing in additional infrastructure in kind of northwest ports for the purpose of exporting more coal, and the cumulative impacts of kind of the wear and tear on rail and those systems. You know, from our perspective, those are all federal investments, and if they are so from a fiscal perspective, the kind of wear and tear and the use of by the coal industry specifically on kind of lots of infrastructure that's being built up for the purpose of the coal industry is a real concern. It's a hidden subsidy, and we'd be very concerned about that. I think that the Army Corps' failure to consider cumulative impacts is, you know, for us, we are like the super nerds in the Army Corps of Engineers. I think there are many instances where when they're doing, there's been lots of studies on the deepening of the Columbia River deepening and the expansion of the ports in Portland that demonstrate that that's not a financially responsible thing to do, and the Army Corps has kind of kept moving forward despite all the different studies that say that. So I think that's, you know, this is just another example of the Army Corps kind of, you know, ignoring reason in some level.
Well, actually, I'm thinking back a couple of years ago, our bulk work of investigative journalism here, the Portland Oregonian, which actually sometimes has some good reporting, and they did a series of articles about basically the whole boondoggle of the Army Corps,
right.
If you're probably familiar with that. And even that, I mean, which was like splashed across the front page, big headlines of the Oregonian for like weeks, didn't seem to affect the Army Corps. Why are they so immune to criticism?
You know, that's a great question. We are big fans of the Oregonian, and we've worked with them on different articles about the Army Corps of Engineers and the kind of question of kind of why isn't the Army Corps more subject to public pressure, subject to reason, is one that we ponder a lot at Taxpayers for Common Sense. I think the Army Corps of Engineers, there's lots of evidence that this is just an agency that has a long, long history of being driven by politics. Its budget has been in the past 80% filled through the earmarking process. So that was literally how they budgeted the entire Army and Corps of Engineers, which allowed members of Congress to pick and choose the projects. We did a investigation with a reporter that identified that, you know, did a FOIA and identified that they literally were saying, we're going to do this one project, the Dog River project. And they drew a little star on the map of a member of Congress's house and said, let's do it close to that guy's house because then I like it. So there's just lots and lots of evidence that the culture of the Army Corps of Engineers is that it's very politically driven. We, you know, we watchdog them a lot. We think that it's one of those agencies that people don't think about very often, and they make big, big decisions because, you know, and again, back to the cumulative impacts of climate, one of our big concerns with the Army Corps of Engineers is that, you know, they often go for the most expensive flood control option, which is not necessarily the most durable and the longest lasting. So we think that that's one of those examples of a financial concern of a real long-term taxpayer liability, is that we do kind of the most expensive and most structural flood control as opposed to non-structural flood control, make sure that we have really strong wetland barriers and that we maintain those and protect them. You know, sometimes that just costs more money for the taxpayers in the long run and, you know, destroys property and makes people's lives pretty miserable if there are big flooding events.
Well, if you're just tuning in, my guest this morning is Ryan Alexander, who's with Taxpayers for Common Sense, and we're talking about some of the non-common sense issues around exporting coal from terminals here on the West Coast, that coal that's mined to the chagrin of a lot of people in eastern Montana and Wyoming from the Powder River Basin. Well, let's talk about some of those cumulative effects. There's issues in every community where these trains are going to go through that, and they actually divide the communities because we keep hearing the terminals and the trains are going to bring jobs. So that should be good for the tax base. But what are some of the corollaries to these jobs that are at least being promised?
Throughout the federal government, whenever there's any action, I mean, this is just always the argument, is that this is going to create jobs. And, of course, everybody wants jobs. Everybody wants people to be employed. That's great. But that's, you know, we have to weigh lots of different factors in doing any kind of development, whether or not it's the terminals at ports and shipping across the thing is kind of, it's also true that, you know, we can create, you know, this is the same argument for defense spending. Every time you say, gosh, we can't keep spending money on weapon systems that don't work, they say, but you know what, if we stop building that one weapon system that never works and never delivers and puts people in harm's way, some people will lose their jobs. These are balanced decisions. They're difficult decisions, but we have to do the things that are making the most sense in the long term. You know, we could, there's almost nobody who would get up with a straight face and say, what we need to do is spend federal money on to give to people to make sure that they have enough money to buy food to keep, just keep jobs moving. We don't do that. The federal government's not a jobs program. We make investments that are going to help communities become self-sustaining. We make investments that help communities become resilient. And it's not clear that these terminals at the ports, the infrastructure to get the coal out the door, and kind of just exporting coal is increasing the country's or these communities' resilience, self-sufficiency, and sustainability from a fiscal perspective. Are they going to be coming back to the federal taxpayer for more money for support for these, for this infrastructure, or is it going to make the communities more self-sufficient? And I think that the evidence is not at all clear that these are not going to be things that where they're not just coming back for more support from the federal government.
Well, let's talk a bit more about some of the impacts of these trains. I mean, we've talked about them on the show before, but just to remind listeners of just how long the trains would be, what is going to be shipped in the trains, what the near track consequences of having all that coal going through communities would be, and then what happens when these trains go through communities that have other forms of transportation that are going to be coming in conflict with the trains?
You know, anybody who's lived around big, long freight trains knows kind of, you know, above grade crossings of the big, I mean, coal trains tend to be open, so the dust is significant, things can fall out. They're not always, but that is one issue. The coal train, you know, they're disruptive to traffic, they're disruptive to other freight shipments potentially. And whether or not they're creating new economic activity by passing through communities is really a big question. So I think the cumulative impacts depend a lot on on the frequency and kind of whether or not what any potential positive cumulative impacts are a question. I'd be curious to know kind of what other guests and what other folks have said about cumulative impacts on train routes. For us, it's really about, you know, again, we're a federal budget watchdog. For us, it's really about, do we need to invest more to maintain the rail infrastructure? You know, the freight companies have an incentive to make sure that that's pretty well maintained, so there may or may not be significant federal investments. We'd certainly be concerned about putting new federal dollars into the rail system just for the purpose of enabling coal to go through, but I should say that it's not clear that that is exactly what will happen.
Well, actually, one of the towns that's north of Portland along the Columbia River, that's going to be was a proposed terminal, and these trains coming through the town, I mean, the town basically is on either side of the railroad tracks, and when the right. trains come through, you can't get from one side of the town to the other.
Right.
And so I'm imagining that's true probably in a lot of small towns that this goes through. Is this an area that you've looked at all as far as it having really negative impacts on the local community?
You know, I think this is one of the, this is not something that we know about at Taxpayers for Common Sense, but certainly just having lived in communities that have big long, I grew up in the Midwest, I've lived in West Virginia, I've lived in the, when you can't get from one side of the town to the other, it's not good for the local economy. And sometimes they'll say, oh, we'll do the shipments in the middle of the night, which isn't always all that preferable either. Having a big long coal train come through your town is disruptive. It's part of business, but it is, it's, most people don't say, what we need in my town is a big, long, dirty train coming through.
And I want to get back to emphasizing, too, that these coal trains are not serving consumers in the United States. So let's talk a little bit about what happens once the coal trains arrive at these terminals. What happens next?
I mean, what happens next in what we're talking about now is that coal companies are taking, you know, coal from taxpayer-owned lands, shipping it on infrastructure that the taxpayers helped build, shipping it to ports where and terminals that the taxpayers helped support and build and maintain, and shipping it overseas to sell to foreign consumers. And at the end of the day, you know, again, we're a budget watchdog. The issue for us is, you know, kind of what's the taxpayer get out of it? We're not getting those increased prices that the increased export prices. We're not getting domestic energy security because we're taking the, you know, potential resource if we did need it and selling it overseas. And it's not in keeping with anything we understand to be good long-term fiscal stewardship of our public lands. If your concern for your guests who work for environmental organizations, if your concern is about carbon emissions, it's not reducing carbon emissions, even if it may be reducing carbon emissions, in your neighborhood, it's not doing it globally.
And that makes it ultimately makes no difference because we all live on the same planet, so it doesn't really matter where you emit the carbon.
I was about to say, I mean, if your concern is carbon, you care about it next door and you care about it across the world.
Well, I wanted to switch topics for just a moment and talk a little bit about oil trains, because that's been a big topic in the last couple of weeks. And it's a really big issue here because I'm sure you've been following the Port of Vancouver, just across the Columbia River from Portland, is considering building a big terminal for oil trains. And this is oil coming from the Bakken oil fields, the shale oil in North Dakota and eastern Montana. And this is also oil that is largely going to be shipped. So I'm wondering, there's a whole lot of, with the big explosion in Quebec a couple of weeks ago that almost destroyed a town, there's a lot of awareness that maybe we aren't quite so on top of the safety issues of whether shipping coal or shipping oil. And is that something that you've been thinking about?
This is not an issue that we've looked at. I mean, you know, obviously whenever, we have kind of a basic position on kind of the infrastructure. We don't oppose infrastructure investments, but we oppose infrastructure investments that are in service of one narrowly targeted industry that are kind of function as a subsidy. So if these infrastructure investments are basically being made simply to make the export of any product more profitable for one single industry, we'd be very suspect of those. In terms of the safety, I mean, obviously that is always going to be both a human concern. Nobody wants explosions of any sort, but also that is also a financial concern, because if they're not being super careful about safety and shipping dangerous products, that's going to, any kind of disaster creates huge liabilities for everybody.
Well, ultimately, what does your organization feel about exporting energy sources? Because it used to be, I mean, the mantra, you know, until recently was the United States must become energy self-sufficient. So we're developing the oil from shale, we're developing natural gas through fracking. well, actually, we're doing everything through fracking, and we are working to with our friendly neighbor Canada to the north to get all that tar sands oil down to the United States too. But the reality of it is, most of the oil and it seems like a large part of the coal that's being mined is no longer being. Is not being mined for the purposes of U.S. domestic consumption. So what is your take on this whole focus of like basically increasing our energy markets or increasing our energy extraction processes for foreign markets?
You know, for us, this is, again, we're different than, environmental groups. We're different from other things because we are really looking at this through a federal fiscal lens. So we look at energy development. We look at energy policy from two or three different lenses. First of all, we look at energy subsidies across all different fuels. So we, we oppose energy subsidies for fossil fuels, and we would certainly say that they should be eliminated quickly because those have been on the, some of those have been on the books for over 100 years, and there's just no excuse for those subsidies to continue to be on the books. That said, we're also very skeptical of continuing subsidies for wind because it's a pretty mature industry, and there are plenty of environmental groups who would not take that position with us. We look at energy development on public lands in terms of from a kind of fiscal accountability in a big picture sense. So we want to make sure that development decisions on public lands reflect potential long-term liabilities, that the developers and the potential polluters are held accountable for long-term liabilities, for preventing long-term liabilities, and for in the long term for any cleanup that may happen, and that whatever development happens on public lands, that the taxpayers are fairly compensated. We did a report a couple years ago on fair market development of renewable energy on public lands because even though that would not create the same kinds of long-term liabilities that fossil development would in terms of it's a big, giant, huge solar field is not necessarily going to threaten the water table in the way that experimental shale development might. At the same time, there are liabilities, and the principle for us is if you're making money off developing a public resource, you have to be responsible for the liabilities. You have to be responsible for paying the taxpayer for the resources that you're developing. So we look at this in a very fiscal view. We are very bipartisan. We work with very conservative organizations and conservative members of Congress as well as people who are very progressive. So we look at it through a very principled position of, energy industries need to be as self-sufficient as they possibly can. And within that, we understand that to mean that they have to pay for the messes that they make, whatever kind of fuel they're creating.
Now, is there any, do you make any distinction about whether the fuel that they are extracting is going to be used in the United States or whether it's actually being extracted for export?
I think where export comes into play for us is really, it's all about the fair market value place for us. I don't think, we don't take a position in terms of I think there are plenty of people who say that you should never develop energy on public lands that would be exported because the purpose of public lands is to provide for the United States. And I think that's we don't advocate that position, but we understand it. Our position is if you're selling it for export and you're making an increased profit, the taxpayer needs to take a share in that profit. That this is about, these are taxpayer resources. If we decide that as a country that those resources should be developed, they can be developed responsibly without creating undue long-term liabilities that can't be addressed and that the developer can't shoulder, then the taxpayer needs to be fairly compensated for whatever market price those resources are bringing to bear. And not, for example, in the context of coal right now, where the part of the problem is, the significant problem from our perspective is domestic coal prices are significantly lower than export prices. So if they're paying an increased price, then that's the price that the royalty should reflect that the taxpayer is able to benefit from.
Well, I want to go back to what you're saying about renewable energy and government subsidies for that, because you mentioned these huge solar arrays that are being built in the deserts. What are some of your concerns about becoming really reliant on government subsidy for renewable energy?
I mean, I think our concern for subsidies for all energy sources is that the government picking winners and losers of energy is not hasn't been something that has always served taxpayers well. It's not, the oil industry has had subsidies for more than 100 years. in the tax code, in other forms. And I think that our concern about subsidies for renewables are like our concerns for subsidies for traditional energy sources, is that it's, you know, there's no kind of special interest that, you know, becomes more entrenched than somebody who's receiving a subsidy. And we're always concerned about unintended consequences. If you look at corn ethanol, which many, many people for a long time thought, corn ethanol, this is going to be great. This is going to be our liquid fuel that is renewable, that is we can produce domestically, that's going to be better for the environment. It's actually high carbon. It's very, very water consumptive. And the corn industry is getting subsidies hand over fist, both through the farm programs and you know, we did finally get rid of one subsidy, the volumetric excise ethanol tax credit, which actually was for corn ethanol production but went to oil companies. But it's still a heavily subsidized industry in terms of the infrastructure to distribute the fuel, in terms of that. And that was done in the name of making sure that we support things that are better for the environment. And corn ethanol is actually not very good for the environment, and it's expensive. And it's expensive to taxpayers. So our concern is that the government doesn't have a great track record of using subsidies in a way that's, you know, there's an argument that people make a lot that, hey, if you just give us 10 years to get off the ground or X years to get off the ground, but that's not how we've operated. We have not, things get extended. Things stay into place so that somebody who comes up with the next technology has an uneven playing field that they're operating on, because corn ethanol and oil and coal all have subsidies on the books, and they've had them there for a long time. Look at nuclear power. Nuclear power is, you know, it's one of the great political ironies, is that, you know, nuclear power really operates all over the world in countries where it's basically socialized, where it's substantially supported by the state. And it can't survive without the level of subsidies that it receives. And did anybody think, you know, that's not what people thought 70 years ago when the industry was getting off the ground. They thought this was going to be the great thing that would transform markets. But it's so capital intensive. The potential liabilities are so enormous that the subsidies have been totally ingrained into the industry. So we just look with a very high degree of skepticism at any subsidy as something that's going to be market distorting, that's going to quash potentially new and really good technologies, and that just, you know, once it gets in there, it's incredibly difficult to get out. So the oil industry, you know, intangible drilling costs, things that have been on the books for 100 years, that's when they put them on the books originally, they didn't say, gosh, I think we're definitely going to need this in the 21st century, but they still have them.
So let's talk about intangible drilling costs. I see that on tax forms. What does that mean, and how is that benefit the oil companies?
The intangible drilling cost tax credit and tax deduction is something that allows oil companies to, it's kind of like an oil company specific kind of R&D tax provision, but they also qualify for R&D tax provision. So it allows them to expense a number of things that they do that are intangible costs.
Meaning,
so
there,
we have fact. I would refer your listeners to. We've got information about all the different, lots of different energy subsidies on our website at taxpayer.net. I could, you know, I love to talk about the intangible drilling costs, but I don't have it at the.
If you can send me the link to it, we'll put it on our website here.
I will.
I think anything that's called intangible, you really wonder, you know, should you be getting subsidies for something that's intangible?
Right. That's a big question.
So I want to talk more about wind, because that's a bit controversial. Actually, there's a running series in the Oregonian right now about state subsidies for a wind project that the Oregonian is thinking is outrageous, if not illegal. But there's been a lot of concern that the subsidies for wind come and go, and it's making it difficult for the wind market to really grow. So why are you feeling that wind has matured to a point where it doesn't need the subsidies anymore?
I think that it's, you know, one of the arguments everybody makes is that they need business certainty. And I think wind has been around for, you know, an industry for a long time. It's starting to, I think that it is looking like it's profitable without the federal subsidies. I think there's, you know, state subsidies are different. They're often about siting, and they're often about competing with other states. It's not something that we work on. We're looking at kind of overall federal subsidies. So I think we just think this is an industry that's been around for a while. They've admitted in some ways that they could take a kind of phase down of their subsidies, and I think that's important. That's one of the first electricity generating power sources that said we can see a future without subsidies, and we think it's great that they've said that.
So let's go back to coal a bit more and talk about some of the other downsides that. And now on this list of questions that I received from your promoter here, it says that the shipping of coal also would have health impacts. We talked a little bit about that, but I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about the health impacts of all these coal trains coming through communities and how that figures into your concerns about federal fiduciary responsibilities.
I mean, I think coal overall, I mean, you know, kind of one of the things that has gotten us most concerned about coal in the, you know, in recent months is, as you know, in June there was an Inspector General report on the coal leasing report out of the Department of Interior that basically said we're losing millions of dollars from a handful of bad lease sales. So we kind of stay on that. We start from the position of that the coal leasing program is selling leases to coal developers and coal companies below market prices. In terms of the additional cost from long-term health consequences, I think, you know, across the board, coal production anywhere in the country comes with a lot of different things. It comes with dust. It comes with potential damages to the water table. It comes with lots of worker consequences. And if you look at those long-term federal liabilities, that's not something we have a number on. That's not something that we've done an analysis on, but it's part of the overall burden of the industry that we were concerned about. But our most immediate concern is on the Department of Interior's failure to really manage the coal leasing program in a way that makes sure that taxpayers are fairly compensated.
Now, do you see that as the coal industry is desiring that these coal transports are going to just increase? I mean, there's a lot of opposition to them going through the Pacific Northwest, and three of the six proposed terminals have been withdrawn. So it looks like there's shrinking support for it here, if maybe not, there wasn't really ever that much support except for a few vocal ports. But do you see that across the country, that there is overall a movement towards increased coal exports, or do you think that actually this is like the last gasp of the coal industry?
I think only time will tell that. I think there's definitely pushback on this. I think there's concern. I think, you know, this is one of those issues that I talk to a lot of different groups from a lot of different perspectives who come from a lot of different political perspectives. And it's, you know, and people, very conservative kind of Tea Party activists and very progressive, you know, climate activists can all kind of agree on this point of should we give away coal below market value so that people can sell it overseas. And people think, well, gosh, that doesn't make sense on any measure. There is nothing about that makes sense. So I think that there is increasing public pressure to bring some rationality and some common sense to the Department of Interior's current coal leasing program so that we're getting fair market value, so that this is something that makes sense for everybody in terms of the fiscal responsibilities. But, you know, is this a tipping point one way or the other? I think it's just too soon to tell.
Well, I see a sort of interesting synergy between your perspective, where you're looking at it from particularly from tax-related issues and fiduciary issues, and environmentalists who are seeing it as the climate change issue of the day. And I wonder how you see those two threads intersect and maybe how coal is one of the most blatant places where these concerns intersect.
I think that the environmental concerns and the fiscal concerns come to intersect around coal because you know, for a lot of these reasons, because coal is expensive to mine, expensive to ship, expensive to burn, expensive once it is burned because of the long-term liabilities associated with increased carbon emissions and the long-term liabilities with coal dust and the long-term liabilities of being around a coal plant, you know, are all things that cost money and cause harm. And so environmentalists are concerned because of the harm and fiscal advocates like us are concerned because of the costs. So I think there's a lot of overlap there.
It seems to me that ultimately it could be that a lot of environmental concerns, if they were addressed, would actually save us money, do you think?
I think in some of these cases, absolutely. It's some of the things that the environmentalists are most concerned about would probably save taxpayers money. I mean, I think that making sure, you know, one of our positions in one place where we're often on the same page as other environmental groups is kind of issues around bonding and long-term liabilities and preventing harm at the points of extraction. So for us, that's about, you know, making sure that developer, you know, energy companies, coal companies, energy developers on public lands are, you know, doing everything they can to prevent long-term liabilities and to pay for them if they happen. And for environmental groups, it's let's make sure your impact is lower. Let's make sure you're doing as little as possible. And I think so. I think that's exactly right. There's that would, if those environmental concerns were addressed, it would in many cases save the taxpayer money.
Well, Ryan, I want to thank you very much for joining us. This has been a very interesting take on what's usually an environmental show. So thanks a lot for giving us the fiscal viewpoint. We've been talking this morning with Ryan Alexander, who's with Taxpayers for Common Sense, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. I wanted to also let you know about an event that's coming up this Sunday. I mentioned it a little bit earlier. It's called Summer Heat, and it's sponsored by Portland Rising Tide and 350 Portland. It's Pacific Northwest says no to fossil fuel exports, and this is particularly targeting the proposed coal terminals that are in Bellingham and Boardman, and I do believe there's one more on the Columbia River. Pacific Northwest is under attack. We will fight back, defending what we love and our right to safe climate and future. Big oil, big gas, and big coal plan to transform the Northwest coastline from Oregon to Alaska into a dirty fossil fuel corridor with over 15 export terminals proposed so far. This month of July will be filled with a series of events. The main action will take place on Saturday, July 27th, with folks from throughout the Northwest coming together to join the National Summer Heat Campaign for fun and family-friendly action. We will combine fights to stop energy extractions, infrastructure, and export, and demonstrate what it would look like if fossil fuel corporations try to imperil the climate by moving fossil fuels down the Columbia River. And so this is happening on Saturday, July 27th. Workshops start at 10. Go to 12:30. There's speakers from around the region from 12:30 to 1:30, and it's all happening at the Columbia River, on the Columbia River at Vancouver Landing, west of 100 Columbia Street in Vancouver, Washington. And for more information, you can go to joinsummerheat.org/PDX. Next week on Locus Focus, we'll be talking with Dominic Kulikowski. He'll be talking about drought, climate change, and wildfires. He's a specialist in wildfires and disturbance ecology at Clark University. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by Kathy Mateo called Coal Tattoo. Thanks for listening.
Traveling on down that coal town road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye, white sycamore, I'm leaving you behind. Oh, I've been a coal miner all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like ironwood, bent by the wind, blood veins as blue as the coal. But veins as blue as the coal. Well, somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head. I said that's a blue mark left by the coal. Little more and I'd have been dead. That new road, looking for a job, traveling and looking ahead, traveling and looking ahead.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
We are here tonight to show solidarity with prison strikers at Pelican Bay Correctional Institute in Northern California.
We have the biggest prison system in the world. We have the highest incarceration rates in the world. If we have a section of the population that's that big, that disenfranchised, and is being dehumanized to the extent that they're living in little cells that are 6 by 8 foot, 23 out of 24 hours of the day in that cell, we're looking at a situation that's going to be popping off pretty soon here. And I think we're starting to feel the first rumblings of that with this prison strike right now.
On Prison Pipeline, July 22nd, hear the rally at the Portland Justice Center in solidarity with the striking prisoners. That's Prison Pipeline, July 22nd at 6:30 p.m.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
All right. Hello, I'm your host for Disability Awareness, Grace Reed, and my guest today is Vegan Sid. I want to start with a little quote out of The Thousand Paths to Comfort. Sometimes the obstacle we must overcome is the path itself. Yes, Sid? What do you think?
Well, I haven't been asked that question before, but that takes me back to 3 years meditating in a Zen monastery in Los Angeles, yes, where I worked during the day. It really helped center my thinking and actually replace my thinking with maybe a more peaceful way to live.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about who you are? Okay. Tell us a little bit more who you are. Who is Vegan Sid?
Well, my first identity, if I think about myself at all, is that I'm a person in recovery. And when I was 34 years old in Los Angeles, as a person who was suicidal and just ready to leave the earth, a series of steps brought me to a program. I have 40 years sober.
Wow.
I want to go ahead and answer maybe a future question, if you don't mind, and that is I don't ever want to leave my roots, where there were times when I would sleep with my dog in a car. I want to stay in touch mm-hmm. with the people in our city mm-hmm. who need us the most.
Yes. And a little bit I do note about you, Vegan Sid, is you are a personal care assistant for a handicapped gentleman.
That's right. And my friend Roy is 87 now, and he served in the Air Force. What we love about him, since I'm not related to him, but want to care for him in the best way I can, because I used to be a CNA and take care of people in their homes, is that he helped us so much with my number one passion, and that is animal rescue.
Yes. And may I ask your age?
My age,